Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Sheila Cast in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. With President Bush as low as ever in the polls, many Democrats are feeling the wind at their backs. And the left wing of the Democratic Party, those who proudly call themselves liberal, believe this may be an historic moment, an opportunity to push their party into power and to the left. The nation, they say, may now be ready for them. This hour, On Point, the case for liberalism and a liberal moment and pushback from the Democratic Center. A bit later, we'll hear from Jean Bethke Elstein, professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago, who says she doesn't see evidence of a liberal groundswell. But joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of the new book, The Conscience of a Liberal. He writes a blog by the same name on the New York Times website. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
And also with me from Princeton is Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. In 1993, Starr was the senior advisor for President Bill Clinton's proposed health care reform plan. He's the author of the new book, Freedom's Power, The True Force of Liberalism. Welcome.
Hi, Sheila.
Professor Starr, let me start with you. Why do you believe that there is a liberal moment at hand, something more than a backlash to the recent years of government?
Well, I'm not actually sure there is a liberal moment at hand. I think there is a liberal opportunity at hand as a result of the default of conservatism, the failure to deal with the great issues facing the nation at home and abroad, and the obvious failures of this latest administration, which played to the right all the way along, and which has led us into a disastrous war in Iraq. I think it's the reaction against that that has created a liberal opportunity, an opportunity to go back to the American public to address these issues and to make the case again. And I think there are signs of a shift in public opinion. Just in terms of voter identification, Democrats at this point enjoy about a 15-point advantage over Republicans. That's the largest advantage that Democrats have enjoyed in many, many years. And I think that is a sign of an underlying shift. But whether it can be turned into a positive liberal moment, into a real commitment to alternatives, that remains to be seen.
And we'll talk about some of that. But let me ask Professor Krugman, how does it look to you?
Well, I agree with Paul that Nothing is guaranteed. Obviously, weak leadership can squander. You know, you look back at the New Deal, and the Great Depression created a tremendous opportunity for liberalism, but without FDR, it might not have been exploited. I'd go further. It's not just disillusionment with Bush. The underlying trends that a lot of us have talked about, rising income inequality, declining health care coverage, people notice that. They may not know the statistics, but they're aware of it. The polling suggests that, I saw a recent Democracy Corps poll where they asked people who said the country was heading in the wrong direction to choose from various phrases, and I was struck that the top two were not actually Iraq foreign policy related. They were about big business getting its way and about politicians not caring about the middle class. We've had now an extended period. We've had an economy that the Bush administration says is just great, but it feels lousy to most people, and that's building demands for something different, especially for starters on health care.
So it's the economy, stupid. Still.
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, national security trumps economics when it's there, but Bush has destroyed the brand on that with the Iraq War. And other issues, and this is a big theme of my book, Conscience of a Liberal, is that a lot of what has actually allowed conservatives to win has been exploiting racial polarization, and that, while it's still there, is actually a diminishing force in American politics. So a liberal moment is certainly available, whether it gets used or not.
I just want to add one thing here, which is that the great American backlash that began in the 1960s and 70s, which was, as Paul is saying, partly a racial backlash, but also a cultural backlash, I think that has been petering out. I think if you look at a lot of the long-term trends in public opinion, in terms of tolerance, for example, toward gays, you see a real shift in a liberal direction. And so that is an underlying long-term force that I think is eroding the base of the conservative reaction.
I'd like to press you on that, Professor Starr, what the evidence is of a shift in a liberal direction.
Well, I'm now talking about trends in public opinion that have been measured over a long period of time, attitudes towards race, towards gender equality, towards gays and so forth, and that is where I think you see this underlying shift. But I think what has brought this to a head right now has been the Bush administration. I think the Bush administration has managed to divide conservatives. The conservative agenda seems exhausted. It's really not clear what their agenda is for the country anymore. Whether it's on Social Security or foreign policy, a lot of things have come to nothing. So I think they've really run out of gas. Yeah, and I think that is what provides an opportunity for liberals and for Democrats to propose alternatives to get the country moving again.
Sheila, can I just weigh in?
Paul? Sure.
Just to follow up what Polestar said, the one poll number I happen to remember is in 1978, as the conservative tide was just about to overtake America, only 36% of the public approved of interracial marriage. Now it's 77%. So it's just a total transformation in racial attitudes. George Bush has given liberalism, in a way, a great gift. I think he has the prospect of being the Herbert Hoover of the 21st century. The Democrats can run against him for decades to come.
Let me ask you first, Paul Starr, where would liberals take the country if this opportunity turns into a moment?
Paul Krugman and I can each talk about different issues here, although I think we have many of the same concerns. I think a lot of them have to do with what might be broadly called shared prosperity. Economic growth has been disproportionately going to the people at the very, very top, whereas the middle class has not been doing well. And we need a new set of policies, including tax policies very much, but other things as well, healthcare reform, that will renew the historic commitment to the middle class and to the reduction of economic insecurity that affects poor people and middle class people alike. I think that has got to be front and center. I think that's why healthcare in particular is going to be, a really crucial issue if we do get a new Democratic administration. But at the same time, we also have to talk about America's relationship to the world and the kind of aggressive unilateralism that the Bush administration gave us that led us into the disaster in Iraq. That has to be reversed. We have to rebuild our connections with our allies and our good name in the world. I think that's going to be obviously dealing with the immediate fiasco in Iraq is going to be front and center, but there's a long-term process of rebuilding liberal international institutions and alliances.
Paul Krugman, I'm sure you have your a lot of that sounded like your agenda also.
Yeah, and I wish we could have an argument here, but maybe we'll have to wait for
we'll have one in a minute, I'm sure, when Gene Bethke also joins us.
Healthcare is usually where people like myself start because it's something where it's an obvious gap in the U.S. system. Every other advanced country has got some form of universal health care. We're unique, and this is biting, and there's a lot of reasons that, this is something that people are more concerned about now than ever before. They were concerned in the early years of the first Clinton administration, but that was partly because the economy was depressed. Here people are upset about, or are scared about health care even when the economy has been growing at a reasonable pace. And if we can get that's a big demonstration project of what you can do towards shared prosperity, as Paul Starr says. Beyond that, sure, lots of other things. This has been really remarkable. I've looked back, and I can't find another period in which the economy, by the top line numbers, by GDP growth, by employment growth, looked reasonably good. But most people said things are getting worse, and this the rising inequality, the failure of shared prosperity, has just become so conspicuous in the Bush years that it really demands policies to change it. And, of course, everything we know about the state of the economy suggests that next year will be more of the same or worse, which means that these issues will be reflected at the polls.
But if there is that kind of focus on domestic inequality, are you expecting that the liberal moment or the liberal movement would take the country more isolationist, less engaged in the rebuilding the relations?
We do have some international comparisons, right? Canada is not protectionist. Western Europe is not protectionist. But they have policies that are all far to the left of anything the U.S. does. We're not talking, there is a trade issue that is going to be problematic within the Democratic Party. Where do we set the boundaries? What are we going to do about free trade agreements and so on? But there's no, mostly we're talking about things like health care, increased earned income tax credits, minimum wages.
This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about whether there's a new opportunity for the liberal movement. We're talking with New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. His new book is The Conscience of a Liberal, and also with Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's the author of the new book, Freedom's Power, The True Force of Liberalism. I'd like us all to listen to Hillary Clinton's answer to a question in the July 23rd YouTube CNN debate. She was asked whether she considers herself a liberal.
It is a word that originally meant that you were for freedom, that you were for the freedom to achieve, that you were willing to stand against big power and on behalf of the individual. Unfortunately, in the last 30, 40 years, it has been turned up on its head, and it's been made to seem as though it is a word that describes big government, totally contrary to what its meaning was in the 19th and early 20th century. I prefer the word progressive, which has a real American meaning, going back to the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century. I consider myself a modern progressive, someone who believes strongly in individual rights and freedoms, who believes that we are better as a society when we're working together, and when we find ways to help those who may not have all the advantages in life get the tools they need to lead a more productive life for themselves and their families. So I consider myself a proud, modern American progressive, and I think that's the kind of philosophy and practice that we need to bring back to American politics.
So Hillary Clinton, by most accounts the front runner in the Democratic contest, says, let's just move away from this word liberal, at least as it applies to me, and talk about progressive. Paul Starr, you've written sort of a whole book on the history of the tradition. What is a liberal?
Well, first of all, let's not get confused by the choice of words. When Hillary Clinton defined what she meant by progressive in that little quote you had, she was in fact describing a liberal. I think she's sensitive to what pollsters are telling her about the connotations, the overtones of these words in American politics. But those overtones have been, to some extent, created by slurs from the right, and I don't think liberals ought to accept those. E.J. Dionne said the other day that no movement which dares not speak its own name has any hope. And I think in this case, liberals have got to be forthright about what they believe. But I don't really care whether a politician calls himself or herself a liberal, as long as he or she acts like one. And from my point of view, all the major Democratic candidates, Hillary Clinton as well as Barack Obama and John Edwards, all of them are liberals in the broad sense. They have some tactical differences about how to achieve things, but their values and goals, I believe, fall very comfortably within liberalism.
I still don't know what you consider a liberal. Can you give me a short definition since we're talking about it?
I think the basic idea is that liberals are committed to an equal right to freedom, and that has That concept of freedom has expanded over time. It used to mean equality before the law, and then it became an equal share in the government. And now it means an equal right to certain basic elements of security, including security in old age, for example. And all of these things, I think, are part of the basic conception of liberalism.
Sheila, if I can just weigh in, I like to say that liberals believe in democracy in the broad sense, that they some economic democracy as well as political democracy. They believe in a shared society, which doesn't mean exact equality, but means that, again, just as Paul was saying, retirement income in old age, access to health care, you know, all these basic things. And this is all, the word liberal has gotten associated with largely with racial politics. Limousine liberals and all that is really about, you know, people who are going to bus your kids. But I don't think you can run away from the word. I think progressive is a useful word, and there's a little bit of a distinction because progressive is a political movement. We have a real progressive political movement in this country now in a way we didn't 10 years ago. But that's about putting liberalism into action. And the Democratic candidates all have remarkably progressive policy proposals. If you actually look at what they're proposing, it's stronger than I think any liberal would have hoped for 2 years ago.
Let me bring Jean Bethke Elstein into our conversation. She's joining us from Washington. She's professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago, and she's the author of Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Sheila.
So you've been listening to us out whether there's a liberal moment or a liberal opportunity. What's your take on that?
Well, I think my colleagues make a very strong case, but I don't find it an entirely persuasive one, and this for several reasons. First, I don't see any strong evidence that Americans support any major redistributive project. Certainly Americans are not fond of appeals couched in the rhetoric of class, because most Americans don't self-identify through class categories. But there's another reason for this, and that is that there's still enough for all the problems with middle class sort of stasis, let's say, not much movement there, and perhaps things getting worse for some, there's still enough mobility, still enough opportunity, still a sufficient number of people who say, by dint of hard work and effort, I've now arrived at a certain point in my income, and I don't really want more of it to go for taxes. And part of this has to do with the fact that people do not trust government very much. I mean, you mentioned, Sheila, at the beginning, President Bush's low approval ratings, but much lower are the approval ratings of the Democratic-controlled Congress, which have been hovering around 11 or 12%. So people may express certain views, but then when it gets down to brass tacks about who's going to be the agent of this, who's going to handle this, they start to get very wary. Let me mention just a couple of other issues. Since I just came on here, one is the question on, let me do a foreign policy one right now. The unpopularity of the Iraq War has not translated into any popular anti-military sentiment. And some of the latest data that I've seen suggests that it's a bare majority, but a majority believe that at one point military force against Iran may be justified. So I think that we should be very cautious about drawing certain generalizations from Iraq, save the danger, Sheila, that you mentioned, that the Democratic Party might get linked to some isolationist tendencies. Certainly, some of the anti-Iraq rhetoric has been very troubling to me. You know, language of the economy, stupid language. We mustn't be the world's policeman and so forth. And it might tend in the direction we've got to sort of, look inward, circle the wagons around, and so forth. Let me just add, apropos this, that anti-Americanism, certainly in Western Europe, preceded in New Europe, but in old Europe, preceded Bush, and it's going to last after the Bush presidency, because that's just the fate of the superpower, to be unpopular, it seems to me. Not to say that there are things that we have done that have things that we've done that have added to that, but that's not going to disappear overnight. And I think those who think that the Bush administration is the sole cause of this are living in some kind of fantasy world.
I want to get back to foreign policy in a minute, but I'd like to let Paul Krugman address your points about inequality.
Boy, there's a whole bunch of things there I disagree with, but let me just weigh in on the issue of congressional approval ratings. Everybody who's looked at this says that you don't want to compare the approval rating of Congress with that of Bush as some indication that the Democrats are in trouble. People are disapproving of Congress for two entirely different reasons. There's a small minority of the electorate who disapproves of Congress because they're not going along with Bush. And there's a large majority of the electorate that disapproves of Congress because they are not taking on Bush aggressively enough. So if you look at the favorability ratings of the parties, I happen to have this in front of me right now, latest Gallup, the Democrats are 54% favorable, 37% unfavorable. Republicans, 40% favorable, 50% unfavorable. The public is making it very clear that it doesn't like what the Republicans are up to. This notion that you can use the low approval rating of Congress as an indication that the public really doesn't want a change in a liberal direction, you can't use that number. That's just misleading. And I was really startled to hear saying, well, the Iraq War hasn't turned the public against the military. Nobody's against the military. Democrats are not against the military. They're claiming that it's Bush who's not supporting the troops. So what does that have to do with anything? I'm just a little baffled.
I can respond to your bafflement, and that is that people trust, as you know, the military, and the Democrats have to, of course, keep making the case that they support the military more than the Republicans do, just by virtue of the history of this issue. But I think they also trust the military in situations of conflict that may emerge in the future. That is to say, I don't think my major point was that I don't think people souring on the Iraq War has soured people entirely on the possibility that the United States, given our ability to project power, as no other country can at this point in time, may well have there may be some military responses that will be hopefully not soon.
Are you asserting then, Jean Bethke Elstein, that it is a liberal position to be against all war?
Well, it seems to me that the way in which many of the Democrats have been talking, again, I think that they haven't made themselves clear on this. That number one, we're in a long-term struggle. This needs to be emphasized more against international terrorism. And number two, there are real dangers in the world that may have to be confronted militarily. So I think the Democratic candidates and those who are in favor of the notion of this sort of progressive or left liberal moment need to tell us under what circumstances they believe the use of military force would be justified and to what ends. I don't think it's just enough to say, Iraq war went south. You have to talk about the conditions under which you believe the use of American force, even if the United Nations doesn't approve, might well be justified. And I don't hear much of that kind of discussion.
I think all the Democratic candidates agree that there are circumstances that may require the use of force. I don't think any of them are pacifists. But what they disagree with is the ease to which this administration jumped to the use of force without fully exploiting all the other alternatives through diplomatic leverage and sanctions and so forth. And that is, I think, what they are keen to reintroduce into our international policies. So, I think there's a clear difference here. It's not whether there are some circumstances. Sure, there are some circumstances that will warrant the use of force. And when we're talking about terrorism, it's really quite a different matter from the case of Iraq or Iran or so forth. There it's more a matter of international policing and intelligence and so forth, and there's really no disagreement about the fundamental need for that. All of these are really canards, Jean.
And I'd like to go to Kevin, who is calling from St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Hi. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, the first time I've ever called in, and I've been with you guys ever since you started up here in Vermont. I'd like to say something. I'm hearing a lot of people saying conservative. I'm hearing a lot of people saying liberal. I don't think most Americans are either one. I think they're very central. We've got a problem in this country. As the parties and the pundits have gotten more and more powerful, the radical ideologues have gotten most of that power. People don't want hard left or hard right. We're looking for centrists, people with a clue, people who will compromise, who will fix problems, not make solutions in search of a problem, and aren't trying to get reelected on day one. And that's all we're seeing anymore.
Paul Starr, what's your reaction to what Kevin has to say?
Well, Kevin, you know, I agree with you that people want solutions, and they would like to see a lot more compromise. And, you know, I wish we had the less polarized politics that existed 20 and 30 years ago when there was a considerable overlap between the Democratic and Republican parties. It's hard to wish that back into existence. It's true, I think, that a different kind of leadership would produce a less polarized politics. I think President Bush helped polarize the politics that we have, and maybe a new president can reduce that and extend himself or herself to the other party and win some backing. But it's going to be very difficult for reasons that really no individual group can control.
Kevin, may I respond, Sheila?
Yes.
Kevin, that was music to my ears, what you had to say. It seems to me that one of the problems the Democrats face at this point in the primary season is the polarizing left wing of their own party. This on foreign policy issues and a whole range of other issues. And I think that it obliges the Democratic candidates to walk this fine line where they want to appeal sort of to the left and then hope that during the election they can move to the center. But in the meantime, they may lock themselves in order to make that kind of appeal.
Can I weigh in on this, guys? I'm baffled here. This is all abstraction.
I don't know why you're baffled.
It's very clear that you can see this.
What are these left-wing positions that Democrats are advocating? They think every American should be guaranteed health
insurance. I'm talking about MoveOn.org.
Gene, let Paul Krugman make his point.
Right? Look at the positions of the actual Democratic candidates, and they're actually centrist in the sense that they agree with what most Americans agree with. If you look at American public opinion, I often try to tell people this, the center of American public opinion is not between Joe Lieberman and John McCain. The American people want universal guarantee of health care. The American people want out of Iraq. The American people want something done to diminish inequality. They're not supporting, and nobody wants Fidel Castro as president, but he's not running. You know, there's this abstract notion that there are these extreme leftist notions in the Democratic Party, but you can't point to anybody who's actually in. You know, MoveOn is not the Democratic Party. I don't see people saying, well, you know, look at the Republicans. They're under the influence of Pat Robertson. And yet Pat Robertson has a lot more influence on the Republican Party than MoveOn does on the Democrats.
Let me give Gene Elstein just a few seconds to respond before we go to a break.
If I may, Krugman keeps talking about canards. May I just mention something about health care? You're quite right that Americans think something needs to be done. But you surely also know that when people are asked about do they like their own physician, are they personally pretty satisfied with their own health care, they say yes that they are. And then they can look at what's happened in countries where they have national
health service.
All right, if we may, because there's more to say on this
issue. Jean Bethke, Elstein, Paul Krugman, Paul Starr, please stay with us. We're talking with New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. He's the author of the new book, The Conscience of a Liberal, and with Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's the author of the book Freedom's Power, The True Force of Liberalism, and also with Jean Bethke Elstein, professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago and author of Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World. Before we get back to health care and foreign policy, two questions we have hanging, I want to go to Mark, calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, to put another issue on the table that we haven't really discussed much yet. Mark?
Nobody's raising it. I think the issue that's been used in this so far in this electoral process to really sort of create fear and division among people, and that's the issue of immigration. Someone raised before that we've done better on racism, anti-homosexual issues, anti-women issues. But what's happened is that we really substituted a new issue, and that's the immigration issue. as a way really to, I think, divide a lot of the natural base of people who may vote for a liberal perspective. And, you know, I just think it's important that we address this issue. Hillary caved in on it. Obama really didn't come clear on it. Nobody, even on the liberal, so-called liberal end, has even really effectively addressed this issue or has backed away from it.
Okay, it's Paul here. I guess let me talk about this for a moment. It's immigration is a very difficult issue for both parties, but it's difficult in different ways. From the on the Democratic side, immigration ends up being a matter of individual, sort of each individual is conflicted. You're not anti-immigrant, but there are problems created by large-scale immigration for social services, for wages. And so Democrats, you know, struggle to come up with a path and don't do a great job of coming up with answers, but, you know, they struggle with it. On the Republican side, immigration drives a wedge right through the heart of the party because the business interests like lots of cheap labor, especially cheap labor that can't vote. But the base views the immigrants with the same hostility that plays such a role in racial issues in the past. The thing about it, as electorally, it seems to be shaking out as something that actually helps the Democrats, because the Republican base won't allow any reach out to Latinos, to Asian immigrants. So the voters that get mobilized are the same voters who would have voted Republican in any case over racial issues. But meanwhile, they drive these new voting blocks into the arms of the Democrats. I think what happened in California is the great model. And in 1994, Pete Wilson won himself one election with a strong anti-immigrant campaign and ended up turning the state solidly Democratic forever after. So this is, it's certainly something that's going to be difficult.
Jean Bethke Elstein, how do you think the immigration issue
well,
I cuts
actually, for Well, I actually pretty much agree, remarkably enough, with what I just heard. It seems to me that this is a very difficult issue for both parties. And there's an article in the Christian Science Monitor this morning pointing out the pitfalls for both parties, including Democrats, because many Democratic voters, including blue-collar workers and some African-Americans, do blame illegal immigration for driving down wages and increasing worker exploitation. So they want stricter workplace enforcement and tighter border security as well. So I think it's a hot one, an unavoidable one for both parties. And I think that it was Paul Krugman speaking that he may be right that the Republicans lost a big opportunity, actually one that Bush was pushing to try to get comprehensive reform and to be more pro-immigration, to find a pathway to citizenship. And this got construed as amnesty and failed. And I think that may, in fact, have alienated Latino, Hispanic voters from the Republican Party, which, if that once happens, that'll stay in place for quite some time. So they're dangerous for both parties.
Ellen is calling us from Worcester.
Can I just add something here, just on the matter of principle and immigration? There's something fundamentally incompatible between having a population of 11 or 12 million people with no political rights whatsoever and the maintenance of a liberal democracy. The existence of that population undermines the rights of citizens because they can be abused by employers, they can be abused in other ways. We need both kinds of policies that liberals and conservatives have been advocating. We need a path to citizenship for the millions who are here, and we do need secure borders.
Ellen is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Ellen, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Although, frankly, a little disheartened at this repetitive theme of bashing MoveOn.org. I myself am a member of the organization. I joined purely out of frustration that we could not get any of our elected representatives here in Massachusetts to listen when we call our local congressman. The standard refrain that comes out of his office is, he's a very busy man and he really doesn't have time.
Can I weigh in? It's Paul Krugman here. I agree. I mean, I did not mean to bash MoveOn, which is actually Now, MoveOn was founded during the Clinton impeachment stuff, which was a case of inside the Beltway gone wild, and it was an entirely appropriate response. And the positions it adopts are not particularly extreme. I just mentioned it because they, in fact, are not running the Democratic Party. Far more extreme, vastly more extreme organizations on the right play a big role in the Republican Party. So, sure, I've nothing, no brief against MoveOn. They sometimes, you know, are a little... They have rhetorical issues, but nothing. They're not advocating at all extreme positions.
Jean Beth Gailton, I want to give you a chance to get back to health care.
Well,
if you can make your point
concisely. Yes, yes. Well, what I wanted to say on that issue is that, as my colleagues know, because they're both social scientists, people expressing a view about something's wrong, we need to fix it, doesn't attach itself to a particular public policy with super glue. And when you get down to the details, you're going to have lots and lots of issues that are going to come up, including the problems with the healthcare systems in the Western democracies that are often pointed to as an alternative to us. In the UK, for example, we find 2 million Brits leaving the country every year to seek healthcare elsewhere. I was in the UK on one occasion when I saw a line of people 3 blocks long because there'd been a notice that some oral surgery appointments were going to be available in a couple of weeks. I was there a month ago.
Surely you know this is irrelevant.
There were stories in the newspaper about people getting horrible infections because they're yanking out their own teeth. They can't get in to get an appointment. Canadians by the thousands come across the border to get health care in the U.S.
Let me let Paul Starr, who probably knows more about health care than any of us, weigh in on this. Paul Starr?
Okay, look. England has a national health service. The government owns the hospitals. The doctors are paid directly by the government. Nobody is proposing a national health service in the United States. England also spends less than half the money per capita that we spend in the United States. There's just a tremendous difference in the level of resources going into health care. Nobody is proposing that we cut the money going into health care by one half. This is simply not relevant to the United States. As for Canada, Canada performs very well by comparison with the United States on almost every measure of health and health care. Gene, actually, you know, there are a lot of Americans going abroad, healthcare tourists, to get healthcare at a reasonable price. Some of them actually go to Canada and Britain and third world countries. So
Elijah,
you're not gonna, you know,
Elijah is calling. Elijah is calling from Salem, Massachusetts, on just this point. Elijah,
hi. I am 22 years old, and I have a kidney disease. And before the Massachusetts healthcare reforms that happened, which is the closest thing we have in the United States to a universal type healthcare system, I was literally kicked out of dialysis units and transplant centers because I didn't have adequate healthcare. Although I did have healthcare through my school, it wouldn't cover enough. As soon as it changed, I got to keep all my same doctors, which I loved, and I got the care I needed. So I don't see what the point is in saying that American people want to keep their doctors. I mean, clearly for me, it worked.
Jean Beth Gailston.
Well, the devil's in the details, obviously. The kinds of plans that are going to be put forward and why they won't look like the sorts of plans that have fallen into trouble in the Western democracies that are other democracies that are often pointed to as an alternative to us. I think, Paul Krugman, you did that in some of your opening comments. So I think we can't look to these other systems. We have to make it absolutely clear that problems have emerged with them and that we're going to have to create our own very American style.
I'd like to register a complaint here. No, I thought we were talking about whether there was a liberal moment, and instead you're doing the bashing of
no,
but the
I'm talking about caution.
No one, as Paul Starr said, no one is advocating a British style health system in the United States. No one is advocating that we spend only 40% as much per person as we currently do. And important point about the U.S. system right now is that little known fact is that in terms of actual medical bills, Medicare and Medicaid already pay more medical bills than all the private insurance companies in America. We already have, in terms of dollars and cents, more than half of a single-payer system. Americans may not know that. Health policy wonks love to tell the story about the constituent who chased the senator, saying, "Senator, don't let the government get its hands on Medicare." But this notion, you know, the attempt to get universal health care could fail. Of course, the kind of scare tactics that we're hearing right now might work as they did in 1993. But that's, you know, this is there certainly is a lot of upset, and there's a lot of possibility.
Well, these I let me just say that I really don't agree that these are scare tactics. This is about pushback, and this is about the kinds of issues that are likely to come up and the kinds of responses that people need to make to the concerns, which is why, as I indicated, one shouldn't say things like we're the only major democracy that doesn't have, because those other programs have problems. You have to point out why we can do it a hell of a lot better than they can.
Speaking of issues, I'd like to hear from Anne, who's in Nashville, Tennessee, and has another issue on her mind. Anne?
Yes, I actually have a bit of a unique situation, and it's an honor to speak to you, Mr. Krugman, as well. I voted for Bush in 2000, and I was in my 20s, and I wasn't paying closely paying attention to politics, but I bought this con that Bush presented that he was a compassionate conservative, I myself being fiscally conservative and socially liberal. Well, after 9/11, I was astonished and appalled that there was this refusal by this administration to tell the American people the truth about why we got attacked on 9/11. And they put forth this ruse that we were hated for our freedom and all these other issues. And then we got torture, and we got the suspension of habeas corpus. We got Guantanamo and warrantless wiretapping. We got massive deregulation and privatization, which has led to disastrous consequences, as we've seen with Blackwater. I myself have devoted the past 5 years of my life to actively opposing this administration and actively participating with grassroots movements on the liberal side. I will never vote for another Republican, ever. And I'm incredibly alarmed at the extremism that has pervaded our government with this administration. And we've moved so far to the extremist right that any liberal president that gets into power is going to spend their entire tenure moving us back to somewhere in the center.
Jean Bethke Elston, how does that strike you, that essentially takes a liberal moment to get back to the center?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think that that any successful candidate has to try to move to the center. I think Bush actually did try to do that, and there were forces in the Republican Party that were adamantly opposed to it, and in this I agree with my colleagues. But I'm a little alarmed at the notion that the administration put out, as the caller said, a ruse about why we were attacked, as if there's some, you know, as if there's some sort of underhanded weirdness going on about the attack. I mean, I think that the overwhelming majority of Americans are right to see this attack as an act of war and as one that is not dependent upon any particular foreign policy stance that the United States takes. When you're dealing with jihadists, you've got to take their ideological extremism seriously. You've got to take the religious motivation for this seriously. The attackers had that. That was what was involved. And I think, indeed, we are hated for our freedoms. All you have to do is to read the fatwas put out by Osama bin Laden and the hatred of women. The anger about rights for homosexuals,
Paul
and all
Starr,
the rest, and
Paul
you can
Starr,
see
the,
that that's the case.
Paul Starr, the kind of thoughts we just got from Anne, does that indicate to you? I mean, that strikes me as, in a sense, classic backlash, classic reaction to the government we've had for the last 8 years. Or is there something more there that leads us beyond the door of opportunity to a liberal moment?
Well, just in terms of what Ian said, I think the way in which this administration misused 9/11 was repeatedly to suggest a connection between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, and to use it as a justification for a war that has not actually advanced American interests, that has actually managed to dissipate American power, even as it has resulted at home in compromise of our liberty. So I think, you know, I think there was something fundamentally deceptive about the way the administration did respond to 9/11. But look, there is a long-term struggle. I agree with Jean about this. There is a long-term struggle against terrorism that's originating from Islamist sources. There are other concerns that the United States ought to have in the world today. There is an emerging, it's been called an axis of oil, in the world, with Iran and Venezuela being centers of anti-American influence now, supported by oil revenue. That's a whole new set of geostrategic concerns,
and a lot that we're going to have to keep talking about. There's clearly a lot of energy in the liberal moment. I want to thank all of our guests, Jean Bethke Elstein, Professor of Social Political Ethics at the University of Chicago, Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning co-editor of American Prospect, author of Freedom's Power, The True Force of Liberalism, and Paul Krugman, author of The Conscience of a Liberal. Thanks to all of you. I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.